Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 24th, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off this week, got an article from Netcraft titled The Bleeding Edge of Phishing, Dark Eelas Suite 3.0 enables DIY phishing of any brand. So phishing as a service, or FAS, these options seem to be becoming more and more prevalent as the days are going by. One in particular is called Dark Eelas, which is a Chinese language platform that was identified back in March of 2024 when it was discovered in a large-scale campaign that leveraged iMessage and RCS for text messages, kind of moving around the SMS to aid in like bypassing the SMS firewalls. So through research, it was identified that this FAS leveraged more variant tooling in their platform, including JavaScript, React, Docker, and Harbor, and things like that, which basically aided in seemingly more complex capabilities. So let's fast forward a bit, and we are now at the release of Dark Eelas Suite 3.0, which has evolved into a full-fledged toolset with pretty incredible ease of use functionality to basically allow anyone, technical or not, to be able to launch a phishing campaign targeting any brand within minutes with just a couple clicks of a button. So previous iterations of this tool set seem to be limited to brands populated within the tool itself. So with new releases, it's pretty much as simple as these couple steps. You open the tool UI, you insert a URL, from the brand or the page you want to impersonate. The platform uses browser automation tooling like Puppeteer to export like the HTML and required assets there. You choose the element you want to place your phishing content in. Choose the template you want to include, like, you know, if you want to do a credit harvest scam, credit card scam, things like that. Restyle the layout if you want to, and add in any additional lures or user input if you want to collect more information. And basically that's it. You're done. You're ready to go. What's even more scary slash impressive is this phishing as a service platform includes more feature than functionality to like aid in the campaigns, with some examples being a full functional admin dashboard, various deception techniques that can be applied. So you can do like unique deployment path for each campaign to kind of hide the deployments from hostname scanning. They include ways to work around like risky IP filtering, crawl filtering, which stops the site from being discovered by web crawlers, and then things like unallowed devices. So if you want to focus on making a mobile-only campaign, you can block anything that's not mobile from accessing, you know, your fish. It also has interfaces to manage the data that you've stolen with your campaign, like credit cards or credentials. And it includes a performance dashboard allowing you to like track metrics and data on all the campaigns that you have going. Dark Eelas 3.0 even provides the user with the ability to generate an image of the victim's credit card. So you can use that to scan into a phone and add to a digital wallet. So what they've referenced here in this article is typically what's happening is people are putting these on burner phones and selling them. So the dashboards and toolings are seemingly really well designed too. So they're using enterprise-grade systems like Docker, Node, React, SQLite, and other third-party NPM libraries and things. And, you know, really the whole point of talking through this is Scott, I was like kind of blown away at how well thought out this thing was. And it was an interesting read to me. The tooling to make things this easy for an attacker should kind of concern everyone, honestly. I will, of course, stop short of the skies falling, but this was impressive, and it's a pretty impressive phishing as a service. It's the most impressive one I've seen to this point personally. So I'm curious, what did you think about this, man?
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating that they can build a single pane of glass better than most defensive tools do when they dump a bunch of proprietary deliverables to developers to say, we want to have this one place where everyone can interact with it and it be like this seamless experience. And we always seem to miss the buck. But the thing is I feel like why they built such a good interface platform or whatever you want to call it for this is it's built by attackers for attackers. Where in the defense space, you feel like it's not really built by defenders, it's built by developers for defenders. when you get to that point. So that might be the miss there, right? Of why we don't do as well in this. But like you said, it's very impressive. The one thing that I thought was interesting too that I picked up on was they talk about the use of a headless Chrome browser to help basically clone these web pages. And I think that's interesting because, you know, with some experience I've had with trying to scrape certain pages to collect data and do things of that sort, a lot of web pages that store all sorts of metadata and things that you might want to collect, sometimes they don't load all that data initially. So if you're using something like Beautiful Soup or something like that, or doing like a wget to pull things down, the data is not all there on their initial pull, right? You got to pull components and stuff like that. And so I imagine that's made it very hard to clone web pages, but doing a headless browser like this, you can then make the page load different parts by scrolling the page and doing other activities within the page. So I thought that was really clever too, but because they're using a headless Chrome browser, one of the things that it's not necessarily going to help you like spot the most definite truths of like, hey, we got to be worried about this. Someone could be cloning our stuff, whatever it is the user agent, right? If you actually use a headless Chrome browser, their headless is actually in the user agent itself. You can specify just like any other, usually web attack tools, you can like state your own user agent for that. But one, a lot of people don't because it can be very tedious. And if you do it wrong, you can make stuff really stand out. But two, because web browsers update so quickly, you have to constantly rotate and change that as well. So there's some maintenance to like really maintain being able to blend in. But then you're like, there's also people like me that have used headless browsers to preview sites in different ways. Nothing for nefarious activity, but I just need to collect data that I don't want to do manually, right? And so there's going to be false positives as well, just for, you know, enthusiasts that know how to use the technology. So, you know, that I thought that was something interesting to kind of look at and pay attention to. It's kind of crazy that they built this the way they did, but, you know, it's built by attackers for attackers. And it's crazy what open source enables you to do as well, because I don't think, you know, they made references to different tooling and different things to put this together. It just shows like how powerful community-based stuff is, both defensive and offensive. Some of the most impressive defensive tools, to be completely honest, a lot of them are open source. And I feel like a lot of platforms that you pay for, sometimes seems like it builds off the ideas that some of the stuff, the open source stuff can already do. So
yeah,
really cool find.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's that idea, especially when it comes to like the phishing stuff, like they talk about a lot of the efforts that were put into place to kind of knock down some of the campaigns and blocks, you know, IPs and stuff. But when you have a platform like this, it can kind of seamlessly roll itself. You know, phishing's all about, you just got to get the one through, right? The defender's got to block all of them. The attacker's just got to get that one. And it's just like the ease of use in this was so impressive. And then some of the screenshots and stuff there in the article that showed how the tooling was functioning, even like pre-built brands over the previous iterations of this tool, where you just the click of a button and you have yourself a Netflix theme phishing, you know, campaign or whatever. And it's just, it's wild, pretty impressive, a little scary. What do you got next for, Scott?
Yeah. So it's from an AnyRun blog and it's titled Zong Stealer Analysis, New Malware Targeting FinTech and Cryptocurrency. So AnyRun, for people that don't know about AnyRun, it's a great sandboxing technology. There's a paid for and a public version. You basically just go to their site. You can drop in things you want to run through, kind of like people did in the past with VirusTotal, like malware samples or files, to see what happens, right? It collects a bunch of information, has some signature-based stuff to help you identify some activities if you're not super savvy to like pull apart the data yourself. But they do provide a lot of data and a lot of information. So from time to time, they get drops of file drops of new malware, right? That either people are suspicious of, or, you know, there's even the possibility that some adversaries could be dropping their own stuff to see what might be detected, right? To try to help better develop defense evasion type activities or things. But, you know, it's one of these things where the interesting part was, I guess this was attackers were actually going after people that use Zendesk. That was kind of how they were phishing for the social engineering aspect. So they're able to either create accounts or acquire accounts that, you know, belong to whatever their target is Which that kind of confused me a little bit as far as where those initial steps happen. But basically, they're hitting people that, you know, have Zendesk with zip files that upon extracting and opening them had some payload specific stuff. Really interesting piece here is the payloads were signed by a Bitdefender security cert that's already been revoked. But it's always ironic to me that, you know, just because something's signed, it bypasses a lot of defenses because they just look for unsigned things. You know, I know it's probably harder for them to do lookups and, you know, revocation type stuff. But that is a common thing where if you can even just look at dates when things were signed or if it's been revoked, if you have ways to validate that in tool sets, it's sometimes can be telling right off the bat. One of the things it does is it creates it. Well, it downloads a down.exe. That's the part that's signed. In running that, it creates a 4-digit bat file. Which upon running the 4-digit bat file, one of the things it runs that's interesting is sometimes you don't see it that often, but I've seen it enough, and we've built content around it. But a trib.exe is associated with modifying attributes on files. They ran a trib with the arguments -r -s -a -h. And basically, the minus sign of the dash is really removing, right? But it removes read-only attributes. It removes the system attributes. So Windows won't treat it like a system file. It removes the archive attribute and it removes hidden attribute. Whether or not you really need to remove all those for this to successfully run, I'm not sure. But to me, when you run a lot of arguments like that on an executable that you don't see that often as well, it kind of becomes a fingerprint for me to look for as far as, okay, I understand a trib could be used, but when it's run like this, this might be suspicious. So those are things that stood out right away. They also have the task scheduler. They create a task. So if you're able to look at logs or where tasks are created, but that's not their primary point of persistence. If you had to guess, you probably would guess it right. They use registry run keys, right, for their persistence. Which is, I think, always interesting that that's a consistent way a lot of these malwares typically stay persistent. And then the really interesting thing, too, is they, after extracting some browser-based data, because it's kind of information stealer-based stuff. So I couldn't tell, but looking at the data they displayed, they basically were creating files both in the Brave and Edge browser directories under the app data, local, and then the browser tree for those. And so I thought that was interesting. I didn't know if that was how they dumped it and then they collected that, but it was a file create log that was being displayed based on any runs telemetry there. So just knowing when file creates happen and then certain directories, I'm certain files get created all the time in those directories. So being able to spot those, but if I remember correctly, they didn't have extensions. They might have just had, which an extensionless file and being created in those might be suspicious in itself. Yeah, there's no extension on those files, and it's actually really long names. It looks like randomized characters. So from a human perspective, obviously, we can see something that be suspicious. But they also, once they collected data, they communicated out to the C2, which was on port 1131. And this is always interesting. They didn't say what protocol they communicated, like if it was HTTP over 1131. But, you know, something to note, there's two different things that usually happen because, like, why this happens this way. One is there's just poor firewalling, right? So outbound connections are typically allowed. So going out should be pretty easy. You just pick the port you want to go on. But, you know, it's kind of an invasive maneuver too, because if you don't have a smart IDS, so, you know, people always have talked in the past about the difference between Snort and Suricata, right? One of the biggest differences between those two tools is how they monitor data. Suricata actually is able to identify the protocol being used and then scrutinize the data it sees based on the protocol being used and the rule sets for those protocols. Snort, you either had it look at everything Or you can specify, oh, if it's on these ports, it's web. So then only have the web rules look at things on these ports. And you can see how there can be a miss and their overhead, you know, depending on what solution you're looking at. So if they are using, you know, standard HTTP web type traffic, if they put it over a different port, some IDS rules won't even look at it depending on how those things are configured. So just a little, I guess, knowledge drop of, you know, why sometimes weird ports are used. And I want to say those are like the key points. You know, it's interesting to see something new, right? But what's also interesting is new things still behaving like the same old, right? As far as malware goes. So different malware, sure. Techniques, mostly the same, right? How we find things. And that's why I like using the methodology on behaviors, because that's great. Someone can create the next new thing, but if they're always going to run it from the registry run keys, it's still identifiable regardless of how cool and savvy the capabilities are. So that's always good for us from a defender standpoint. So what was your thoughts?
Yeah, some, you know, the first thing, not to take a stab at it, but I wonder if you know, the many times we've discussed the single character files has changed. I'm not going to lie. As soon as I read that, I said, oh, they use a random 4-digit. I'm like, oh, man,
I know.
They might be listening to Scott. They're changing tactics a little bit here, huh?
We haven't had one this year, I don't think, right?
Have not. I don't think so. No, if we did, it was the very first show of the year. But yeah, I mean, you see so many of the similar tactics and behaviors. The one part that I thought was interesting, though, was that this was targeted not at the user, but at the agents. So they were going after chat supports. So say they were posing as customers, initiating chat supports with companies like Zendesk to fish in that direction. You don't often see that. I mean, I've definitely seen it before. You've seen things like that where there's people trying to interact in that way. But that direction was I thought, worth noting, right?
Well, it's a big win if you can compromise a hub that interacts with multiple
cards. Correct.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this was pretty interesting. I always do almost have a sigh of relief when you see that. You know, a lot of the stuff that we've looked at over so many years with the different behaviors and the techniques that are commonly used just be repeated. I mean, there's no reason for them not to, right? They still work. But from our perspective and our realm of threat hunting, like it's almost comforting to see that. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Well, what's interesting is I think that shows that threat hunting isn't as prevalent in organizations as we probably like to think. And I say that because the registry run key is an easy thing to look for, right? But if you're ever in a large organization and you look at that data, there's a lot of false positives that you either have to tune, figure out, understand to be able to address that. But if you have a mature threat hunting approach, then you know that you can't build detections just every time that happens. And you have to know how to look at that data on a regular basis to make it proactive and procedural to say, hey, what is new that I might care about that might point to something that got past our defenses and, you know, and how we respond to that. So that's one of the reasons why I feel like it's always worth bringing up the same old strategies, because they still work because people aren't hunting for them.
Well, it's core. It's core to learning how to kind of do that. But I think also like build the confidence of like, hey, yeah, you have these sophisticated actors that are doing these you know, seemingly complex things.
We're not making them work that hard, right?
Right. And here are things that you can do to defend yourself. So you could build that confidence as, hey, I can find these things. I can, you know, so yeah. So it's
junior kind of comforting.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Cool. What do you got for us next?
All right. Next on my docket. So an article from Talos Intelligence titled "Weathering the Storm in the Midst of a Typhoon." So monitoring the recent attacks on U.S. telecom, carried out by the threat actor Salt Typhoon. I'm sure most have heard about them by now. Talos Intelligence produced some detailed insights into and observations into those attacks. Their report discusses the hallmarks of the campaign in a way of using living off the land techniques, as well as reports of various leveraging of Cisco vulnerabilities and some of the activities that they observe. So credential use and expansion. Primarily leveraging the use of stolen credentials, There's also been recorded details of Seoul Typhoon stealing local accounts, capturing SNMP, TACAX, and Radius traffic, including the secret keys used between the network devices and the TACAX or Radius servers, seemingly in an attempt to kind of further enumerate the credential details. Exfiltration of configuration information of TFTP and FTP infrastructure pivoting. So this is a significant part of the threat actor's campaign, where routine lateral movement efforts were done within compromised environments. And even pivoting, one noted thing that I thought was interesting is pivoting from one telecom to another laterally, which is interesting. The configuration modifications that they talked about. So the Seoul Typhoon would modify device configurations routinely, leveraging bash and guest shell. Modifications for IP address changes, GRE tunnel creation and use, access control list modifications, adjusting the HTTP, HTTPS settings on standard and non-standard ports and more of that, creating users by modifying the /etc/shadow/etc/password configurations, adding SSH authorized keys under root and other users, and generating SSH servers on high ports to kind of aid in their persistent access. Also, they noted a use of custom utility dubbed Jumbled Path, which allowed for execution of packet capture on remote Cisco devices through like actor-defined jump hosts. So that utility would also do something that we've seen, another common thing, another easy bullet point for hunting is when you look for log files being cleared. So that utility would routinely clear the log files and to kind of like impair the further, it would also like stall logging to impair logging to continue as they continue their attack. It also aided in obfuscating communications from the threat actor between their source and desk with their C2 and compromised devices. So they discussed various bullets to aid in like the detection and preventative measures. One low hanging fruit, like I had mentioned, is looking for the clearing of log files. So in this particular case, since they were targeting Cisco devices, what they had mentioned is the .bash_history files. So that's a pretty easy one to target if you're looking for some activity that's suspicious in this kind of light. It's a common tactic with threat actors to kind of hide their tracks, and again, easy to find in most logging setups. But ultimately, what I took away from this article for Seoul Typhoon is that it's just more information that they don't really aim to recreate the wheel. I think almost everything I've seen from Seoul Typhoon, I mean, they're clearly active, have sophistication, and they do a lot of different things, but they really just kind of go at open weaknesses and use things that are just, you know, living off the land, common stuff that you would see. They just do it really well. And it wasn't necessarily a whole lot of net new, but it was interesting to see a little more detail on how they were targeting the various vulnerabilities in the Cisco devices and some of the things they were doing. But yeah, all in all, I thought it was a good read and just more information on a pretty prevalent actor group right now. But what do you think, Scott?
So you have to remind me, but I'm pretty sure that the Typhoon class relates back to China, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So when you mentioned the target set being like, yeah, they kind of just grab what is available and they seem to hit different targets based on kind of availability in a way, or, you know, but, you know, that I think that speaks to, well, one of the big things that motivates China is like economic superiority, right? And yeah, in order to compete with that, you would be very opportunistic, especially if you can get into places that you might not necessarily like gain a lot of value from, but then you might give you access to other places, or you can leverage information. So like, it's kind of like how I feel like they operate a lot of ways, is where it's like, if I can get my hooks in here, what else do I learn? And then from learning those things that might direct me to put hooks in other places, you know? And so it's about control and about access, which is nation state centric, except for there's more economic probably drivers there. But what I thought was, you know, very interesting here is, one, it's not often you hear about people actually targeting network devices as much as it was historically. Usually people would try to get passwords. That was one way where people would get elevated passwords, is they get into a network, they target a network device to try to get elevated passwords, or maybe they try to get to a network device so that they can create a path out of the network if it was really locked down, back when networks were more simple and So it was easier to kind of control the flow of traffic. So, you know, those are some aspects that people would actually target those. But from out, because, you know, I remember even when I did like network security back in the day, when I was learning how to do networking, it was like, how do you protect the configuration, right? That's what it was all about. But they were really interested in learning about the environment by utilizing the configurations. And then when they did PCAP or captured packets, they targeted specific protocols that dealt with authentication and things, so they can get kind of more understanding on how to potentially gain more access and things. So I thought that was also really interesting, because I figure at telecom, if you're just siphoning packets out, if you looked at NetFlow alone, I imagine that would just bubble up like, whoa, why are we seeing like 10 gigabits of traffic streaming on this one interface, you know? But that also leads to, maybe that's what it means by jumbled path, their tool. Maybe it's about breaking up that collection. So if you wanted to even collect it all, you're sending certain protocols certain ways and certain protocols another way. So it breaks it up, goes through jump posts, and then they can reconcile and put it all back together. I'm not sure. They didn't really specifically call that out, but it would be an interesting use case for that if they're collecting that much more data. You mentioned some, the clearing of the logs, but I know that there's ways to collect logs off of these devices. And I can't remember if people were to use specific commands, if that's easy to collect. There may be like an auditing. I'm really, really digging deep into my old networking days when I wasn't like a super network guy, but I started kind of doing a lot more network things. If you can set up auditing on specific commands, right, to capture certain things, because obviously if you're capturing everything putting into the device, you're basically collecting the configuration, right? But if you are able to audit certain commands, they do list some commands, right? TCP dump, TPA cap, cap start, cap clear, cap export to FTP, address, whatever. You might be able to actually develop some logging around those type of activities, and make sure you're collecting. If they're there, you should collect them, right? It's just a matter of the level of collection, depending on if you're like, yeah, just give me everything and I'll figure it out later, or if you can actually go in with a scalpel and really be more decisive. Because I know from some of the syslog stuff we saw from networking devices, there was a lot of data, right? We'd see like the alerting, right? Like a interface goes up or interface goes down type stuff, which is not that helpful. There's logging to be done and said there. And it's interesting because they did pick targets that usually people don't have a lot of visibility into. Usually the people that actually are monitoring network devices are network admins and engineers. It's usually not the security center. So it was interesting.
Yeah, that's the, we've had some experience kind of leveraging and trying to build detections and things around some of these kinds of devices, right? And like you said, the network stuff, at this point in time, I think a lot of it's generally overlooked, because it's kind of like it's the door handle on the door, right? You're not really considering the door handle, right?
People always were more concerned about exploitation than anything else, and clearly that's not what we're doing here. Yeah,
no, and it's a lot of smash and grab in some places, and we've experienced this. They're sensitive about how to enable what kind of login on a given device, especially when it might sit in a critical network or have a critical file stream. Yeah. So you run into a lot of headaches there, but there are things that can be had, right? One of the ones that I've always thought was a pretty easy win as far as like looking into anomalous activity or suspicious activity on a device like this is any of the ACL or the access control list modifications. That's a pretty common log in these devices. It's a pretty easy one to log. It doesn't have a lot of volume and it shouldn't happen all that often. And when it does, it should be relatively easily explained. Yeah. So that's when it comes to these kind of devices, that's just one easy win in my eyes. That's low hanging fruit that you can win really quick on just capturing those logs and enhancing your visibility there.
That was, another thing, GRE tunnels, they did say they created new GRE tunnels and things, right? Tunnels are created like an interface. So the interface up and down, you should be able to distinguish between normal interfaces and tunnel interfaces. And if you're seeing tunnels coming up, same thing with ACL modifications, that shouldn't be that often unless like it's a tunnel that somehow got bounced and came back. Then you'd see the down before the up, there's things like that to look for. And then the loop loopback interface IP address modifications. I mean, that's another interesting one too, right?
All right, Scott, what do you got last for us this week?
Let's see, what do I have last? It's an async rat related one. This is from the Cyber Express, and it is called Ghost in the Shell Null AMC Bypass Security to Deploy Async Rat. So AMSI, or I call it AMSI, I don't know if that's how what everyone else calls it. Just so everyone knows, it is a security-based tool to protect against malicious scripting on Windows system. It's kind of like antivirus, but specifically for scripting. And then, so a lot of times people use malicious scripts or script interpreters to do certain actions. And one of the things they always have to do is do AMC bypass type techniques, which is good because if what they do in the script is hard to detect, sometimes these bypass techniques might make it easier. So it's a give or take, depending on what you're really looking at. But this one was interesting. Execution flow. There's a lot of things to be said about, you know, how I look at detecting this. But basically, at the end of the day, they were able to deliver async rat, which is a remote access Trojan that gives someone basically access to your device to do all sorts of things they want to do after the fact. But they started out where it looked like they were targeting people that were trying to pull down a wallpaper, right? And it looks like the campaign was actually targeting Portuguese speaking, or no, I'm sorry. The threat actor seemed to be a Portuguese speaking threat actor, based on some of the forensic analysis and some of the scripts to help, associate that. So kind of where this is coming from. But the wallpaper was a shortcut, right? It's what had the null AMC bypass type stuff. So, a null character, a lot of times you'll see it's like the caret above the six on the keyboard. So depending on what you're actually writing things in, you can insert special characters in certain scripts. And if the script interpreter, like PowerShell or Command Prompt, and things like that, don't care about that, it just treats it as a null character and doesn't break the script. So you can scatter your stuff with these special characters and it doesn't do anything other than sometimes impede analysis. But the fact that these things actually exist in a script is suspicious, right? There's no legitimate reason for someone to break up their code with special characters when there's so many other ways to obfuscate that it's not necessary. So by doing this, that shortcut, when you launch it, actually launches the command prompt, which then later will launch PowerShell, and it looks like it runs an encoded command. But either way, you've got a shortcut link that's going to launch command prompt. You know, you're not going to be able to see the null characters. I think you'll see it on the command line log. So you'll see them show up there. But you're obviously not when you execute a shortcut, it's not always easy to see. That's the start of everything. But either way, you're going to have the command prompt launching PowerShell. PowerShell is then going to download, and there's only a few ways PowerShell downloads things, but it's going to download a TXT file, which it will also then execute that TXT as a PowerShell script because that's what it is. So you can see this multi-stage thing, which will then pull down a bat file, which will then basically open up an image that I guess was the wallpaper you're going for, and then launch the bat file itself to download another PowerShell script, which will then do some reflection loading with the .NET app into the PowerShell memory and also disable the AMCI and the firewall. So that they can have more play. But I think the payload they put into the PowerShell memory with the reflection loading, the .NET app is the async rat itself, right? So that's how they get it running in the system. So it's always amazing to me, if you have security monitoring, like why this chain of events can happen. Anytime you have command prompt launching PowerShell, which launches more PowerShell, a command prompt, which launches PowerShell, there's no legitimate reason to bounce back and forth between those things, right? It's just already, I'd be like, okay, well, there's something weird going on here. I might not be able to tell you what it is, but I don't like it, right? And then knowing if you have PowerShell logging turned on, you capture a lot of this information and a lot of obfuscation that's being used in some of these scripts. Most of the time, Windows will deobfuscate that if you've got the logging turned on. because they'll log what's actually being executed. So that's something to take note. And the other thing that's also interesting, we talk about the common techniques, right? Async RAT's been around for a long time. Well, the one interesting thing about async RAT is one of the ways it persists is it just puts itself in the startup folder. So every time you launch your computer or log into your computer on startup, boom, it launches your stuff. Now, that's interesting, right? Because it's a really easy thing to look for what's being dropped in startup folders. Now, I say easy. Natively, it's not necessarily easy if you don't, you know, possibly apply some really good tools to support that. And this is why I always talk about Sysmon as a good example, because file creations and the level, how granularly you can get for watching for specific areas, either what's in the file type or the location, can be hugely impactful here, and very simple to set up with not much, you know, as far as overhead when it comes to collecting data. So, you know, look at things like that for solutions. But like I said, this is a cut and dry good example to say, hey, what does the common bad things look like? And, you know, and some people even ask, like, you know, what are some things you look for first? Honestly, if I dropped into a network and they're like, hey, can you like find something? I would just look for these types of patterns of how command prompt and PowerShell is being executed, just to get an idea of what the environment looks like as well. So yeah, I don't know, what's your take about something like this?
Yeah, and I mean, to add to that last point there, it's, you know, just thinking about it live, dropping into an environment and just looking at, okay, well, how often are encoded commands being run by PowerShell?
Right.
So small things like that. It's like, it could tell you a whole lot really quickly about an environment. But no, yeah, the first thing that I thought of when I read this, and this is kind of going to be a little more simplified off the technical, away from the technical side, but I was like, we are talking about malicious LNK files disguised as wallpapers. And that just made me laugh. I'm like, holy crap, like this many years in, and that's like, you know, still a...
When was the last time you were hunting for a wallpaper?
Man, it's, you know, I mean, I understand the vector, right? Because like we learned about that, you know, a lot of us started in that area. It's like, hey, you know, look at this malicious thing, malicious wallpaper, right? When people were just throwing them things on. And you would think that like over the years, and it's I guess maybe wrapped in a little bit of arrogance because of the profession. Not arrogance might not be the right word, but like, it's like, man, this is still happening. But I had to laugh about that. I had to bring that up because that was too funny. But yeah, ultimately, I mean, I can't add too much more than what you did on this one. I just think that, you know, it harkens to some of the real common things that are just like, they're exciting and kind of fruitful. Like, I really think like, if you're just starting off or you're just diving in, like, go look in your environment. How often are encoded commands happening? What is your visibility in the PowerShell scripts being run look like? Really simple things that could yield so much fruit.
Cool. Yeah. So that kind of closes out, but there's some things to mention before we go here. One, we have our fourth top cover, which I'll be talking about. It's titled Threat Hunting Management Workshop, Hiring Effective Threat Hunters. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. I'm going to try to start about what does it mean to build a team, hire the right people? What does that look like? And what are some things to think about? You know, I'm not going to give you the solution because I might not have the solution, but at least some ways to approach the problem. And then we also have our live podcast happening March 13th. And that's from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The previous one starts at 12 as well, but it's not as long. And then we also have another workshop. It's a Threat Hunting Foundations workshop. So moving beyond IOCs to behaviors and TTPs. So it's really about, you know, breaking into what does it mean to look for behaviors, and starting to mature how you maybe think about the problem when it comes to threat hunting. That is going to be March 27th from 9 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. So it's a full-fledged workshop. It'd be good for those that are interested in getting into the space or those that want to learn about it or get better. That's still a good thing to attend. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 24th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.